Now, we need to know where receptors are and what they do. And there's no way out of this. We have to just sort of like bite the bullet over this and actually do the best we can to memorize what the different receptors are at the different tissues that are innervated by the autonomic nervous system. I'm starting with what happens when you activate a muscarinic receptor in the eye. Well, there are two sites for muscarinic receptors in the eye. One concerns the sphincter muscle, which is responsible when it is activated for contraction of the pupil, pupil reconstriction, if you like. That's called meiosis. And that's what you get when you activate a muscarinic receptor on the sphincter muscle. And the ciliary muscle is responsible for accommodation to near vision. And if you contract that, as you will, when you activate the M3 receptor there with acetylcholine, you'll get accommodation for near vision. Now, mind you, if you activate it with too much acetylcholine, instead of just accommodation, you may get actually cyclospasm. That can occur with too much of a good thing, in other words. Now, if you go to the heart, you'll notice that we've changed the receptor subtype. I'll show you in a few minutes what the different receptor subtypes are biochemically speaking. But the M2 receptor, you may recall, is a receptor that's present pretty much exclusively in the heart and pretty much exclusively in nodal tissue. Both the SA node and the AV node have receptors for acetylcholine. And the action of acetylcholine at the SA node is, since it's a dominant control of heart rate, is to decrease heart rate. And that tends to be rather dominant in terms of parasympathetic activity on the heart, that they actually act to slow heart rate. It happens also to have a negative, what we call a negative inotropic action, which means that it happens to have a mild action on inotropism. AV node is also inhibited by acetylcholine, and the velocity of conduction across the AV node is inhibited. So the M2 receptors are cardiac receptors, and they are muscarinic receptor subtype, distinctive from those in the eye, which are called M3 receptors. Now you'll notice that from this point on, with one exception, everything where acetylcholine is a neurotransmitter becomes M3 receptors. Everything else seems to be M3. So if you were guessing in a question, you know, what you could do is say, well, if it isn't the heart, it's probably going to be M3, right? Because pretty much everything else is M3, with one minor exception. In the lungs, we have muscarinic receptors responsible for contraction of bronchiolar smooth muscle. Not a good idea, is it? Because you can't breathe if you have contraction of that smooth muscle. And in fact, too much of acetylcholine can lead to a bronchospasm, just like it can cause cyclospasm in the eye. Too much of a good thing. Likewise, acetylcholine increases secretions. Well, that might be good when it's mild, but too much of a secretion, again, blocks airflow. So what we could say here is that if we had too much acetylcholine, it's going to be difficult to breathe. Would you accept that as a sort of conclusion here? I think you should. Now, what does that mean pharmacologically? It means that if we do use something that increases acetylcholine at these receptors, we may get respiratory difficulty. The converse is also important. What if we were to block these receptors with drugs? Do you think it might help out? You think it might help our breathing? If you believe that, you'd be correct, right? Because by decreasing the activity of acetylcholine on the bronchioles and on the secretions of the glands in the lung, you actually can improve respiratory function. And we have a number of drugs that are muscarinic blockers that actually are used in the treatment both of asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. So you can begin to see there's some method in wanting to know about these different, there's some sort of, if you like, magic in knowing about the different types of innovation because you can relate them to pharmacology. Remember, I can only tell you this in this way because you know some pharmacology. If you don't know any pharmacology, I have to be much more slow in terms of describing it to you or illustrating it for that matter. The illustrations wouldn't have any meaning, but you know something. That's important. Okay, what about the GI tract? Motility is increased by parasympathetic nervous stimulation, whether it be the stomach, which sometimes can cause cramping, or whether it be the intestine, which sometimes can cause diarrhea. These are M3 receptor systems. But we have an exception here. This is the one exception other than the heart where things are not M3. M1 receptors are responsible for secretion of acid. And that's in the stomach, and the glands will stomach and small intestine, and the glands will release acid. And what's the relevance of that pharmacologically? Well, if we could cut that down by using a muscarinic blocking agent, we might have an antacid function. We really do have that, but it's not of great clinical use. We've got other ways of dealing with excess acid secretion, but just for the record, this is the only muscarinic receptor outside of the heart that is not an M3 subtype of receptor. So I thought you'd like to know that. Bladder M3, sphincter M3. So contraction of the bladder wall and relaxation of the sphincter and relaxation of all sphincters, actually, other than the lower esophageal sphincter. So these are the aspects of GI and GU function. What about glands in general? Well, we already said that thermoregulatory sweat glands are muscarinic receptors. That's an M3 type of action. Right, even though it's innervation from the sympathetic nervous system. Salivation is obviously an M3 action, as would be lacrimation, tearing. Blood vessels, and this is really fascinating, have receptors on the endothelial cells that theoretically are responsive to acetylcholine, except they don't have any nerves. These receptors lack innervation. And in fact, if you were to activate them, you actually release nitric oxide, or what has formerly been thought of as endothelial-derived relaxing factor, EDRF, which appears to be largely nitric oxide. So if a drug is capable of activating those receptors, it can release nitric oxide, which can lead to vasodilation. But there are no nerves there. How does this come up in the examination? Well, what do you expect a cholinesterase inhibitor to do to that particular receptor? The answer to that is nothing. Nothing, right? Because there are no nerves. And if there are no nerves, there is no acetylcholine. So muscarinic receptors for acetylcholine are present in the eye, they're present in the heart, the bronchiolar smooth muscle, they're present in the smooth muscle of both the gastrointestinal and genitourinary system, they're present in the glands, and all of these sites are innervated by the parasympathetic nervous system. There are also muscarinic receptors on the endothelial cell in the vasculature, but there are no nerves that innervate those particular receptors. Where are the nicotinic receptors for acetylcholine? Well, we may recall we split up the idea of nicotinic receptors into nicotinic receptors that are present in the adrenal medulla and in the ganglia of both branches of the autonomic nervous system. And we called those nicotinic N sub N types of receptor. Well, in the adrenal medulla, of course, activation will lead to the release of catecholamines, most dominantly epinephrine, but to a certain extent norepinephrine as well. And this is an aspect of neurohumoral transmission, which comes about through activation of the sympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system. The receptors in all autonomic ganglia, both sympathetic and parasympathetic, of course, when activated, can cause multiple effects, but the effects depend on the relative innervation of a particular target gland or tissue. In some cases, we have dual innervation, and in those cases, one branch of the autonomic nervous system may be more dominant than another. So activation, of course, would lead to an increase in the dominant type of pharmacological response. And of course, if there is only single innervation of an organ system, then clearly the activation of the ganglia would lead to activation of that system. So it does depend both on innervation and on the dominance. Now, the neuromuscular junction is, of course, not part of the autonomic nervous system in the context of skeletal muscle, but it is a nicotinic receptor that is activated by acetylcholine, and acetylcholine then causes depolarization of the N plate, which will be expressed as initially a twitch or fasciculation, and then obviously a contraction of the skeletal muscle. The nicotinic receptors then are perhaps, when we think about them in the context of comparisons with muscarinic receptors, less diverse and pharmacologically actually somewhat less selective, I think we can say. Now, what about the idea of autonomic nervous system dominance? When we have, and as we do in the case of the blood vessels, a single innervation from the sympathetic nervous system without any parasympathetic innervation, then you could make a pretty good guess that if you activated a ganglia by nicotine, for example, you would get what is the dominant effect of sympathetic stimulation of the blood vessels themselves, which is a vasoconstrictory effect, and that would be rather anticipated. In the case of dual innervation, for example, where we have both sympathetic and parasympathetic fibers to the gastrointestinal tract, or in terms of the glands, etc., then the dominant particular branch of the autonomic nervous system is the one that will be expressed. So we expect ganglionic stimulation then to lead to increased gastrointestinal motility and probably increased secretions. So this is examples of how the effects on the ganglionic transmission really are determined by both innervation and dominance. Now, what are the mechanisms involved in terms of second messengers or in terms of our descriptions, really, of the different ways by which drugs can be exerting their actions when we consider effector mechanisms? We can say that as far as acetylcholine is concerned, we have really both examples of ion channels being affected when they're coupled via G proteins, and ion channels being affected when they're not coupled by proteins at all, but are actually directly coupled to the receptor. For example, muscarinic M1 and M3 receptors, and M3 is the dominant type of receptor in the peripheral nervous system. Most M1 receptors are in the central nervous system. Both of these are coupled to a GTP binding family of proteins called the GQ proteins. And these are the ones that activate the enzyme phospholipase C, leading to the increased production of the second messengers, diacylglycerol, DAG, and inositol triphosphate, IP3. Both of these lead to ultimately activation of calcium-dependent kinases. Now, the receptors for acetylcholine in the heart are the M2 class of receptors. These are also G protein linked, but the G protein here is a protein that inhibits the activity of adenyl cyclase. So it would be called a GI protein. So GI couplings involved in the effects, for example, of vagus nerve stimulation. The vagus nerve releases acetylcholine at the level of the SA and AV nodes, happens to activate the enzyme to inhibit the enzyme adenyl cyclase, leading to a decrease in cyclic AMP activity, and that is the mechanism of the effects of acetylcholine on heart rate. Now, in contrast, nicotinic receptors don't use second messengers. Here, the receptor is directly coupled to cation channels. Both sodium and potassium can run through those channels, and the most important ion, of course, is the sodium ion, because that's the one that brings about a depolarization of membranes by virtue of carrying a positive charge from the outside of the cell to the inside of the cell.